You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. In their new book, Unquiet Voices, The Magical Art of Laying Ghosts, authors Rob and Nonnie Douglas draw on their 30 years of experience. Combining classical necromancy with modern investigative methods, they offer a fresh approach for communicating with spirits and explain their paranormal histories and tips next. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to my two latest patrons, Mike and Deb, and thank you to each and every one of you that continues to support the show. Thank you. Don't forget Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. You can subscribe to our Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. Please visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. You can also visit our exclusive merchandise site, available through TeePublic, with the link in the show notes. Our intro and outro music are, as always, performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's join Rob and Nonnie to learn more about the unquiet voices that exist all around us. Many modern paranormal investigators seem to be obsessed with technology and gadgets to assist them, yet they seem to be missing a trick by ignoring some historical skills. By combining medieval and modern techniques, investigators can understand far more. And in their new book, Unquiet Voices, The Magical Art of Laying Ghosts, Rob and Nonnie Douglas offer us a fantastic handbook to guide us. Rob, Nonnie, I am delighted to welcome you both to Mysteries and Monsters. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Paul.
What a fascinating topic this is. As I was joking before we started our proper conversation, necromancy is one of those subjects, and this is something that you both deal with in the book, that I think very similarly. I was speaking to a druid recently, and it seems that there's a lot of bad PR that's been attached to both the world of the druid and the art of necromancy over the years due to religious persecutions in the past. And I think it seems to be probably the easiest point in modern history that we're able to look at these subjects and look back with an unbiased opinion without our view being skewed by the ruling classes of that particular era. For you two, with your experience over the last 30 years and your travels and your experience in working in these fields, do you think now is probably the perfect time for a book such as this, reintroducing people to the positive benefits of using necromancy?
You know, I think in a lot of ways it is. It's very often the thing that people live with. I think it's 3 out of 5 Americans believe in hauntings and 4 out of 5 Britons in the last Gallup poll. And it's something that is very difficult to escape for those people who grow up around it or they're surrounded by it. There's so much interest now in trying to understand what is in those invisible realms. And as we were preparing for this book, we spent 1,000 hours just looking at shows on paranormal investigation.
People's personal investigations.
And one of the things that kept coming up was, I really wish there was a handbook, or, you know, we're going into uncharted territory. We just don't know. And what we were seeing was so many errors, I guess, and misconceptions that has been known and have been practiced for, you know, over 1,000 years, maybe in quiet traditions, things that have survived, things we wouldn't necessarily call themselves necromancy, but yet could come under the banner of working with the dead.
Also, you're quite right. There's a lurid imagery to necromancy that came out of the persecutions and uber rationalism from Victorian times and what have you, that's filtered its way into the media, and the media has kind of enshrined it. I mean, a lot of us are visual thinkers, and when you think about necromancy, you think about the images you've seen or the books you've read and what you've imagined. And the reality is, it's like a lot of magical traditions. It's a workhorse system. It's very practical, and those sorts of imagery just gets in the way. And it's about time, because paranormal investigation has grown so wildly popular, it's time to sort of revisit it and say, you know what, this isn't really all that strange, and it can be understood.
Well, I think this is the thing, and it's not just necromancy that seems to fall under this kind of cutoff point, because as someone that's been surrounded by the paranormal my entire life, my grandmother would consider herself at the time to be a seer, or a psychic, as would be the more common term these days. It's always been something that we've had a very open relationship throughout my family, going on into my adult life and into the modern day. And so when I look at the history of paranormal investigations, you can see this cutoff sort of in the mid-90s period, where it seems that very few modern investigators will utilize anything or anyone who researched or investigated or wrote about particular cases prior to the mid-90s, which I think when you look at the body of work that you've released with this wonderful book, along with people such as Harry Price, and you go back to people such as Catherine Crowe, that there's so much we can take from looking backwards that we can use in our modern toolkits or our modern investigations, that I think there seems to be far too much emphasis on technology, even though in the majority of cases, it seems very clear that people don't know what these gadgets are supposed to do and don't know really how to use them properly.
Well, absolutely, because I think they're not sure what they're trying to measure. And if they're able to measure something, what it is that that's causing or what it is that it's doing. Most of the sources that we've used in the book are prior to the 16th century.
Mm.
You know, this has been a phenomenon that has been surrounding people just like you and the way that you grew up. I think that there's a lot of people in that situation where it was very normal. And those observations, they get recorded, they get passed down the same way that you probably, you know, was very normal to you, and that you saw things around you and you were able to detect things, you know, over a period of time. When those things get documented and it becomes a little formalized into a teaching method, then we can start to see these patterns. And we're going back to, I think our first reference is, you know, talking about identifying spirits from the first century.
Hmm.
Also, you know, human beings are incredibly innovative. And when you look back in history, they were innovating, they were experimenting, they were testing, and they were proving things, and they were coming up with methodologies that worked. And today we're doing the same thing, but you have to remember that paranormal investigation is very, very young. And so it's experimenting with new technologies, it's experimenting with ideas. Going back to the 90s, the idea of paranormal investigation was always to seek scientific proof of the paranormal. Mm. Well, as you know, with your family situation, sometimes the luxury of looking for proof is already, you know, the horse is already bolted.
Yes.
And so then the question becomes, why, and what do I do about it? And recently there's been a move in paranormal investigation to try and understand what's going on, to try and find ways to resolve it. And so, you know, paranormal investigation in my mind is actually growing up, and it's kind of falling into line with what the old necromancers and people who lay ghosts did.
Mm. Well, absolutely. I mean, I've been very fortunate over the years to speak to several parapsychologists, and I've always considered myself as someone that's gone on ghost hunting and done investigations of that manner in the past for fun more often than not, or also to sort of sate my thirst for historical trooping around and discovering wonderful things in some wonderful locations. And I think when you sort of start to unpick the parapsychologist view of the paranormal, you suddenly realize that actually it's not the ghost hunting as the traditional modern sense would be that really appeals to me. I think it's more of the fact that it's the challenging questions that it comes up. It's why do certain people have certain experiences in a group of people and other people don't? Why does this happen? Why do certain locations seem more of a magnet for spirits or hauntings or ghostly encounters? Why do some people wish to see a ghost and never get to see one, whereas some people, more often than not, people who don't want to see one have an experience, which usually leaves them sort of wondering what on earth is happening and why they've been chosen in such a manner? And so when you start to look at the more thoughtful processes that go behind this, I think you suddenly realise that this isn't a fear factor situation here. This is a quest for knowledge. This is searching for answers, because I think it doesn't matter what culture or religion, or even if you're an atheist or an agnostic, the one question that most people need to know is, what happens when I pass? And I think, regardless of whichever way you attack that subject, in the heart of ghost hunting is the real hope for people that those we love and those that love us will somehow have a contact that they can use whenever we've shuffled off this mortal coil of ours.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's immediate. You'll have experiences. The more you're involved in it, you'll have experiences that really can't be denied. Unlike, you know, paranormal investigations that go to a haunted place or hear about activity and then they go and investigate it, in this sort of work, you're actually going out to where the disturbance is causing a problem. So the disturbance is very prominent. So that you come face to face with the fact that it's real pretty quickly. And it does open up that question of sort of the human experience, like ghosts are people. And we try to understand ourselves and our world around us. And here we have a very unique way of exploring that. And I think that that's a big draw to that sort of field.
Very much so. Very much so. I mean, this is one of the aspects of the modern paranormal television show, that these days, if I hear the word demon mentioned, I come out in a cold sweat, and it's not through fear, usually. Because I'm not suggesting that I'm the most well-read paranormal researcher or investigator or lover of the subject ever, but I can see the massive shift in the last 20 years, because what used to make certain cases stand out in the past was their ferocity, their violence, the fear that it instilled in it, whereas the vast majority seem to be quite sort of, not mundane, but sort of pleasant hauntings, where it would just be somebody wandering about or things being moved here and there or whatever.
No, I was going to say that's absolutely true. I mean, one of the errors we try to avoid is an error of perception, because most ghosts, if you want to call them that, are innocuous. And, you know, not everyone becomes a ghost when they die. Very few people do. And among those that do, the vast majority are just people holding on to one attachment or two attachments that they're just going about their business.
Hmm. Well, this is the big thing, I think. This is when, because I think one of the things that often can cause some real problems for people, and I've spoken to lots of people and I've read lots of things over the years, that for some people, when you have a spirit that comes back to visit a particular relative, this tends to then cause problems with the other relatives, because then they seem to think that this is some kind of paranormal scoring system. And therefore they would say, well, why haven't I had a sign? Why haven't I seen something? And obviously the other show I do is called The Ghost Story Guys, which is a UK Canadian show that we do. And we get readers and listeners sending in their personal experiences. And so we've had these kind of questions several times over the years. And I think some people become so fixated on seeing an apparition that they can recognize, that if they have another kind of experience that may be coming from the other side in whatever form it may take, and when you read enough cases, you can see there are all kinds of things coming on, of signs from using animals as a channel, perhaps leaving coins or moving certain things, or a song will come on in a certain period. It doesn't actually have to be seeing the person you've lost to have that connection, does it?
No, and it's usually not. See, what we call ghosts are those that are held back in their transition by their attachments. Most people, the vast majority, will go through what we call the gates of death. They'll move on to where their soul is supposed to be. Their means of communication, once they've done that, are things like familiar feelings or a smell that brings them to mind. Like you walk into the kitchen and you smell bread and you remember your grandmother cooking bread, or sometimes animal things, you know, butterflies, things like that. They don't communicate in the same way at that point. And if you look at a lot of mediums, they'll have symbolic messages, that symbolic forms that they interpret when they're contacting these spirits, because the souls that are communicating with them have already moved on. So they're using symbolism to inculcate a message. Dreams are another one. Hmm. Ghosts are more in your face. If they want to to give you a message, they're going to move something, appear, stand at the foot of your bed when you wake up. They're going to have these sort of more direct communications because they're closer to where we are.
But that doesn't necessarily mean it's an apparition, obviously. As you were pointing out, there's lots of ways to communicate with the deceased. And I think that, you know, one of the things that as we move through this and we encounter is that some of the things that we have always taken for granted because we just have a normalcy around the fact that there are spirits and spirits can communicate, and that growing interest that you now see in ancestor veneration that is sort of making a reemergence, people sort of systemizing it and talking about it. You know, Llewellyn is a great publisher of books along that ilk. You know, as people are starting to differentiate between communication on a soul-to-soul level with something that they cannot see and separating it a little bit from the excitement of the paranormal, and the two can go hand in hand. They don't have to be one or the other. It's quite part of the paradigm of experience that you can have these really close experiences with someone who has passed and they can communicate with you in ways that are very difficult to explain, and then also have these more physical experiences with something that is, you know, making you feel cold when you walk in the room, or that, you know, feel just makes you feel a little paranoid. And those kinds of experiences are different, but they're no less dealing with the dead.
Right.
Yes. I think this is often the situation where if people have only a specific point of reference, or they've seen a particular investigation, or they know of a particular case, that seems to often completely guide their feelings about the paranormal or spirits or hauntings or whatever. And I think sometimes, as with anything in life, the more resources and contrasting opinions you can have on a particular subject often allows you to then become more nuanced and more knowledgeable and have a better breadth of situations and the kinds of aspects that the paranormal holds in different facets. It's not, as I say with many things in this particular thing, it's not a one-size-fits-all when it comes to situations like this. And obviously, I would imagine both of you have had situations where you've dealt with and assisted people with certain types of hauntings. I would be very surprised if you could say that case after case is the same. There will always be specific differences to each particular haunting or spirit that is lurking somewhere that you have to perhaps use different techniques or access different parts of your personal knowledge and also reference books to then sort of work out a plan of communication, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, nothing is one size fits all. All you can do is create a system for yourself, for your investigation and your resolutions, that's principle based, that you can go back to and through the analysis process, come up with a strategy. Because people, just living people, are unique and different. And so when you're dealing with spirits of the deceased, it's equally as complicated. They're unique. They have to root out what the attachment is that they're holding on to in order to help them. You have to understand them on a very psychological level. You have to try to get inside their head and see what's motivating them.
Yes, I'm surprised often that people don't prescribe personalities to spirits more. I think there seems to be often broad brushstrokes are used when the subject of ghosts turns up in certain channels where everything seems to be there. And I often find that peculiar because they'll say, oh, well, it's a relative or it's a close friend or even a pet, perhaps, that's come back. And you seem surprised that perhaps that they still have that personality there, or they're doing their favourite thing. You know, I've spoken to people and heard stories about people. They've seen ghosts reading a paper, dancing, just doing mundane chores. Even one fabulous story, which seemed to be some kind of time slip story, which was involved somebody making a sandwich. And so it's the mundaneness of certain encounters, I think, which makes me smile often, because sometimes I think we expect spirits, to do all kinds of magical things when more often than not, they're just doing what they enjoyed in life. They just happen to be doing it from somewhere else. That's all.
Well, how many pictures have you seen where there's a umbra or shadow figure or an apparition just standing there looking at the person taking the photo?
Yes.
I mean, they're incredibly normal in a lot of ways.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. But it's surprising that some people will often give these entities intelligence, or they will say that they know what they're doing, and yet they seem surprised when they have personality as well, whereas I think that surely that's the whole package, is it not?
Well, yeah, you can't do this work if you don't understand people. They are people, and sometimes they're people in distress, but they're no different than anyone else you see when you're walking down the street. They're just in a different set of circumstances.
I mean, for you both as well, as we were saying in the introduction, necromancy has been with us since the times of the ancient Greeks in different forms, and the techniques have developed, with the greatest of respect, in nearly three millennia now, since it sort of had its...
Well, possibly earlier.
Yes. Well, absolutely. I mean, we are confined by our limits of the information that we've yet to discover. And as we often find, when certain people draw a line in the sand and say, right, well, this is when that started. Mm. All of a sudden, within 10 years, all of a sudden they find something else. They go, oh, actually, we'll just move that back 500 years now. Everything. Yeah. But that, I suppose that's the good thing, especially when it comes to things like archaeology and the history of evolution and things like this, where when the evidence presents itself, people realise that, yes, we need to keep going back. And you only have to look at cultures all around the world that what we thought we knew 100 years ago, in a lot of fields in that particular realm, and you could certainly say this the same about the supernatural or the paranormal, that our understanding of the world around us and science and different dimensions and the ways certain elements on this planet can react in different regards to how they're treated or the places they can be found in. And so this is surprising for me that there is a lot of necromancy sort of DNA in its early days that's still very relevant today, which once again shows the level of intelligence that the first practitioners had, because these were learned people who were very well trained. And yet we sometimes presume that anybody from less than 300 years ago, they all seem to be idiots unless they lived in Greece or Rome.
Yeah. Necromancy as a formal ritualized system is as much a part of the Mideast as it is of Greece. And Byzantine Greece, or Greek Byzantine, I should say, period, was rife with philosophical discussion and ritualization of these sorts of practices. So it was natural that it would move into what we consider medieval necromancy, because it's very informed by that period. And it drew from both Greece and the Middle East. So, I mean, it's a continuum of practice and experience, and, you know, and accumulated experience. You know, you can trust what stays, because it's passed through generations of people who've tested it and tried it.
And I think a common misunderstanding is that there was this ancient history, and then we have modern history, and everything in between is colored by, you know, what we can describe by the dominating religion at the time, and nothing else was occurring at the same time or alongside it. But what we have is all these adjacent traditions that co-opted a little bit from Christianity, who kept on going back to these ancient sources. We go back to them because we have them documented. And just the way that we can look back to them, you know, our predecessors also look back to them. So we have this very interesting period in medieval necromancy where, you know, Aristotle was something that was regarded in educated circles. It was okay, you could look at Aristotle, but not so much some of the other philosophers. And so we kind of have this terminology that reinvents itself in this medieval period, applied to indigenous and native traditions of Britain. And so what we're seeing is this continuous tradition. And although we might look at these, some of these names that seem quite foreign, or maybe they've moved into Latin, it's really just that the education is moving on, that as you have these sort of apprentices where you have a master who's instructing an apprentice, that the information is moving on, but at the same time, you have the same kinds of traditions and the same kind of practices happening in less educated circles. And they're still doing the same kind of work because the work needs to be done. When you have interaction with the spirit world, when there's a collision between worlds and, you know, everyone's not happy about the way things are going, very often people are happy for the spirit world to remain where it is. It's only when it starts crossing over and they can see it or it starts causing a problem that it becomes a problem. And, you know, under those circumstances, that's when you might get someone in who knows how to deal with this situation. In our case, we have the more rural Scottish tradition of laying ghosts, but it really comes from a very educated background as well.
Well, this is the thing as well. Necromancy was a lifelong pursuit for the earlier practitioners all the way through. This is not, as often can be the case, that it's something you can just take a little piece of, spend an hour on it and think, right, well, I now am a necromancer. I'm away. I'm off. It is one of those disciplines. And I think whenever you're dealing with this particular subject, you're never an expert. You are limited by the knowledge you have attained up until that point of your life. So you will be experienced, you will be knowledgeable. But as with anything in this particular field, nobody knows everything. And I think often too many people are scared of saying the words, I don't know, or I'm not sure, rather than sort of leap to strange conclusions about something because either they don't have the knowledge or they've not come across a certain circumstance like that, or it's a situation that they've not dealt with previously. And therefore they will try and fix it inside the box of their knowledge, which can sometimes limit how they react to these kind of experiences, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, the words, I don't know, are incredibly powerful. And they have to be because it keeps you grounded. I mean, you're throwing yourself, when you're doing work like this, you're throwing yourself into an environment that's incredibly dynamic, and going in with a conceited preconception can often throw you and can lead you down, totally down, you know, some random wild path. But no one is ever going to be a true expert. We're all still apprentices, no matter how long you're practicing. And you're always learning more. And I think that having that attitude is essential, especially if you're going to be the type of person that people come to for help, because there's a responsibility there, responsibility of care.
Very much so. I think often, sometimes the investigation takes it away from the person that's having the experiences to the person doing the investigation. And therefore, that seems to be the wrong way to deal with a particular problem or situation that someone has called out for help for, because I've spoken to people in the past before where they've had teams turn up and gone, yeah, we can't deal with this anyway, bye, and they just leave them. And then you end up sort of seeing these people very desperate for help, because often as well, this is the other aspect, sometimes it depends on that particular person's background, their belief system, where they live, how they live their life. Often some people will be very reticent about searching out help and saying, I think I've got a ghost in my house and I need a hand. Because often, as we've been saying earlier on, sometimes the responses that they will receive will be framed by that person's belief system. And therefore, they will say, you're imagining it. Oh, your medication's too strong. Have you been drinking? Oh, you're under stress. Or they'll say, oh, it's definitely a demon. Or what have you done wrong? As though it's the person's fault that they seem to be experiencing some kind of haunting or supernatural experience in either their home or their office or even in a particular place that they visit regularly.
Well, that's also a historical perspective, too, because while some areas laying ghosts is a ritualized process to help the living as well as the dead, there was in the radical Protestant period this idea that if you were haunted, it was your fault. And their idea of laying ghosts was to have you go through a purity sort of process, because clearly you wouldn't be haunted if you weren't sinful.
Yes.
And so that idea still is around, you know, the idea that you're going to be censured or persecuted because you have an experience that's out of the norm.
And that was definitely something that motivated us, because we did see a lot of people being victimized by the process of paranormal investigation, because as you said, it does make a bit of a hero of the investigator, especially if it's being televised, and doesn't always help the person who's really there needing help. Or maybe everything calms down and then 3 weeks later it all sparks up again, and this time it's a little worse. Or maybe they're just afraid and they just needed someone to tell them it was okay.
Especially when it comes to where you have to cohabit with a spirit, because there's nothing wrong with the spirit. It's not actually doing any damage or any harm. And the people living with it have to learn how to react in that environment and become comfortable with the fact that, well, they've got a house guest. And to be able to find someone to help someone reach that level of tranquility where they can accept that, it takes some time. And because this is a very scary thing, as Noni was saying earlier, when that world and this world collide, it can really throw people and they have to readjust.
So we always advocate, when we are trying to help someone, to really work with their existing beliefs, no matter what they are. And maybe there's some room for education, but really, you know, what's going to make them feel comfortable? What's going to help them to adjust to a situation and help us to resolve a situation is really to sort of work within what they believe, not try to convert them to a different way of thinking, and then find a resolution that is just peaceful for everybody. Nobody wants to see, you know, people living in fear and being afraid of being in their own home, and no one, you know, would want to inflict a further feelings of confusion or torture on a spirit that might just need help as well. So in our practice, we have, because I would say that Langos is a very small component of what we do and how we do it. It's just come to the fore for the purpose of this book, just because it was needed. And, you know, it, like you said before, there is a time where this has become apparent that people are ready for this information, they want to enact it. And at the same time, those individuals and those traditions that were protecting the border are dwindling in number. The information wasn't there for them to work with and to pass it on and to teach. And the people there, they just weren't there to receive it. So I think we do have these new generations where, with a proper understanding, with just a little bit of a different perspective, with a compassionate approach for a situation, you can look at the whole thing a little bit differently. It isn't about proving that the paranormal is there. It isn't about, you know, determining whether a place is haunted. It's about everybody kind of, you know, finding their resolution.
Well, that's very interesting as well, because I know, Noni, you are very keen on helping people sort of regain their origins and look in regards to their sort of traditions. Have you often found that people may consider themselves a particular follower of a way of life or traditions or a religious following that is sort of counterintuitive to what their actual centering point is, if that makes sense? That perhaps the reason they're having difficulty with it is that they're trying to deal with a problem with the wrong kind of medicine, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, you know, in a lot of instances, those frames of reference, those beliefs don't allow for this to happen. You know, the only experience with a spirit you can have is with the Holy Spirit. And, you know, and all these other things that are happening. If you're seeing things or hearing voices, then there must be a scientific explanation. And it's really just that we just need to take that frame of reference and just expand it out a little bit. It doesn't need to go very far. You know, if it's logical, if it's practical, if there's principles, if you can sort of show someone that the logic to it and that they can see results, once they start seeing results, then they can understand it. And it's okay for them to hold on to whatever faith it is, but maybe some of the doctrine just has to get a little looser because once they've seen it, once they've experienced it, you know, it's very hard to go backwards.
And it's also important to remember that belief or faith is something that people reach for, but what they experience is what's happening to them. And it can cause a division in their mind and create a massive amount of confusion, but often it's accepted too. I mean, right back to areas like where you live and some of these rural areas, and even in some cities, you'll find that people will be of a particular faith that the doctrine is not really supportive of these types of spiritual events. But because they've grown up around it, because members of the family have experienced it, because they've seen things that they can't deny, they kind of, you know, have this sort of subtract where they just follow that is real. My beliefs don't really explain it, but it can be two things at once.
Yes. Yes. I think often it's very interesting when you have experiences that will often be shared from places such as Ireland, Scotland, Cornwall, Wales, where you seem to have two belief systems running parallel, and the person who has these beliefs is very comfortable with saying, yes, I consider myself a Catholic and I believe in fairies, or I consider myself a Protestant and I believe that ghosts are all friendly and it's all fine. And for me, and you mentioned this in the book, is the amount of places where people's personal beliefs have either sort of shrunk away slightly, or they've known how to sort of fit in, shall we say, without causing attention. Because I think a lot of people, especially in the British Isles during the 16th and 17th centuries, were very careful about what they said to certain people. And you reference one of my least favourite people in history, James I of England and James VI of Scotland, due to the writings and the persecution that he oversaw throughout that period, and obviously all the way up until Cromwell and some of the things that were going on there, until, strangely enough, the return of Charles II, thankfully, seems to put the end to that sort of black period, especially in British history, guys. And so that's always been a very interesting thing when I've spoken to people from Ireland or Scotland, that they are very comfortable. They've got this kind of comfortable relationship with all aspects of their spiritual beliefs, and neither seem to contradict the other. They've found that happy medium, which I think in the modern era, some people seem to be find a real problem sort of finding that balance.
Yeah, and you know, there's this academic theory that went around for a while, still popular in Eastern Europe, but Western Europe's kind of forgotten it. They haven't really repudiated, they've just forgotten it. It's this concept of high religion and low religion. High religion was the cult of the nation. Okay, so you could remove the old gods and replace them with a new god, and that was what everyone did. They went to church now. Low religion is those spiritual agencies you interact with on an everyday level, and they don't go away because they're objective experiences. So it's easy to be a Catholic and believe in fairies because there's no contradiction there. It's high religion, low religion division. And you find it across the world, but you also find it in Europe. And so you look at syncretic systems like Afro-Caribbean systems like voodoo, where they'll be Catholic, but they'll also be whatever line of voodoo they may be. And to them, there's no distinction, because high religion and low religion are living together in harmony in their mind. It's when it's not in harmony and you start questioning yourself that the confusion sets in, because you have to question what you're experiencing versus what you're being told should be the experience. And that's where people get confused.
Yes. Yes. I suppose as well, for both of you, what was it that attracted you to necromancy? Because lots of people are interested in paranormal investigations and the ghosts and hauntings, and some people would say that they fall into the sort of pagan pathway or Wicca, both of which have also had a massive rebirth in the last 20 years, which I think is a fantastic thing. If you'd have said to me 20 years ago what I would consider myself, I would always have said previously I'm an atheist and agnostic at best, if I was being polite. But the more I've spoken to people and the older I've got and the more I've become to appreciate the world around me, I clearly find myself sort of aligning with the animist sort of pagan belief system, that I believe that there is magic in everything.
Yeah, and we started off, well, I started through living tradition and practicing living faith and living traditions that came from the UK that led me to esoteric and occult traditions, and I became involved in those. And so as soon as people find out that you practice that sort of thing, they assume you have all the answers.
Yes.
I was 18 when I received my first initiation. I didn't have any answers, but people assume you do. So when someone has a disturbance in their home, the first person they're going to think of if they know you is you. And so, and of course, if you're a caring person, you want to go out and help where you can. So it kind of led on from there, like to do the job better, because it was not going to quit. People would ask you to go and do the job regardless.
Yes.
So to do the job better, we started looking into necromancy to sort of define some of those principles, so that, we could be more efficient in what we were doing, because, it's a sense of responsibility and duty of care, as I said earlier. It's very hard to walk into a home where people are traumatized and scared and to turn your back on that. You want to help.
I think, another thing this has given us, and we have mentioned before that we, living tradition, that there is this practice, there's this family practice, and that is seems very normal. It's henotheistic. We're happy for all the gods of all the people to exist. We don't really, want to tell anyone that their beliefs are wrong. But we have our own priorities and our own beliefs that we practice. For me, coming into it, I learnt from Rob's grandmother and mother how to lay a soul to rest, not necessarily going out on an investigation. It was actually quite interesting to me. We'd get called out to these situations and Rob would just have it all wrapped up in a minute or two. He would be able to kind of look at it and go, okay, I know what's going on here. I know what I have to do. Much, much quicker than the actual process of what we describe throughout the book. And really what we're doing is we're trying to give a context to that kind of knowledge, which comes from generations of culture and is passed on in very nuanced ways, but you can't convey that to somebody who hasn't had that experience. And so putting it into a different language, using necromancy to the context that we had and recognizing that the same things existed there in medieval necromancy, that there was a language for it, that there's words for it, that there's, a process that we can describe. And, our hope is that people will take this and internalize it so that they can then have the knowledge to also quickly understand a situation, have an investigation, do the things that are fun and exciting to do, but do it with a sense of responsibility and a sense of practical and logical analysis, because the goal should be that you walk out of a situation and you don't leave it worse than when you walked in.
And also we tried to use medieval ceremonial magic as a universalist approach rather than a specific tradition. So that, okay, so we're using Greco-Latin terminology and we're giving you these methodologies, but no matter what you might actually believe or what tradition you might follow, you'll find these in the cultural language of your tradition. It's just you need to recognize it first. And then you'll look back at what you do and you'll say, oh, I get it from this perspective. We call that this. And so we tried to stay as universalist as possible while giving a definitive text that you can follow through.
I mean, there are two striking things from the book that I've taken with me is the constant reference to compassion. And I think this is one of the key things in paranormal investigations, I think, often gets overlooked. And as you refer to there, Nonny, you will often see situations where people have had certain investigators teams come in and they do everything they need and they get all their footage and they go, oh yeah, it's terrible. And then they go and they leave the person with a worse situation because they've used the wrong practices. They've inflamed a situation. They've thrown paraffin on the fire and exactly. Basically happily walked away and gone, right, we can close the door and go home and we don't have to live there anymore. But also, as you've also both touched on, is you're not saying to people, this is the only way. You're saying this is an additional benefit, skill set, knowledge base that can help you be a better investigator. And I think for both of you, that's a very refreshing attitude to have, because too often, as we touched on earlier, some people will say, well, it's my way or the highway. And if you don't do it that way, well, that's why it's going wrong. And yet throughout this, there are these two strands that give a real positive attitude throughout the book, which I think is, as I say, deeply refreshing. But also, It's the aspect of many times compassion towards the spirits is completely overlooked or not even considered by people. And I think, as we've said before, we're talking about personalities and beliefs and whatever the reasons are for these people being tethered to where they are. You've got to treat those situations with compassion as well. And that often is just never on the table when people do investigations.
Yeah, absolutely. There's certainly, you know, a community responsibility that we have. It's why we have funerals. It's why we have, you know, in most religions, prayers for the dead or some kind of service. We continue to look after our community while they're alive and then after they've passed. And the modern approach that we can, once they're dead, and if they didn't get to where we think they should have been, that we can treat them like they're some kind of invasive force or...
The other.
Yeah, the other. You know, that attitude is not going to lend anyone, you know, any benefits. You know, it's dehumanizing to the investigator. It's dehumanizing to the spirit. And it's also, you know, very confounding and frightening to the home or to the situation where this situation is occurring.
I don't know if you noticed, but throughout the book, we use a very neutral they when talking about spirits. Because if you listen or watch these shows or read books on paranormal investigation, they'll often refer to the spirit as it.
Yes.
And we were very careful not to do that because, although sometimes we did by accident when we were writing, we had to edit it. But we really wanted to present that these are human beings and they have to be approached as such. They're not the other. They're not that foreign thing that we should be afraid of. They're people and often people in distress.
I would expect that over the years that you've been working together and assisting people, as you mentioned briefly there, Nonnie, I would imagine you've had to go in more than once to a place where someone's had someone in and everything's gone to hell in a handcart, as it were. And therefore, they require a more studious approach to their particular experiences being dealt with. Do you think that's more common these days, or that you've been working and assisting people, you can see it more and more? Or do you think it's always been that way? It's just more visible these days because there are more outlets for people to see bad investigations.
It's a very interesting question, and I'm not sure that I have an answer for it. What I can say for sure from personal experience is that I see a lot more situations where people who are interested in and get involved or dabble in the fringes of magic and have some ideas. Some ideas without some training, and so they start getting involved in things, or they develop, as you suggested, kind of like, you know, this kind of, you know, a train wreck of assumptions about how things are.
Yes.
And they start getting involved with spirits. They don't know what they're dealing with, and they start working with them. And I've, you know, been contacted by a few people who are quite traumatized by people working magic or claiming to work magic, that have taken sort of young people and tried to involve them into a practice where they're working too closely with spirits and that they're having these very traumatic experiences from it. And I think that it's that lack of understanding when you start working in things that you don't understand. You know, certainly I don't want to be someone who says, you know, don't be interested in magic or that there's some kind of evil intent attached to it. But what I would say is that it is a very nuanced and requires study and preferably a mentor or some kind of guidance, and that there is a long history of that can be attained. And we try to give a base or a background in that kind of work. So I work, although it is towards paranormal investigation and people who are working with spirits, we really try to give a foundation of some magical principles that take it away from some of the modern ideas that are out there that just grow, like, you know, TikTok ideas, I guess. and start putting it back into something that's a little bit practical, something where there can be some magical protection, where there can be some kind of accountability. Because the most damaging situations I have seen, I've definitely seen some people who have been dealing under the oppression of spirits that we would call predatory, but I've also seen people deliberately getting involved or calling predatory spirits to individuals.
Yeah.
That they believe is some other kind of practice other than what it is.
I also, to your point, when Paranormal Investigation came up with this idea of provoking spirits, that did interfere a lot, I think. I did see a change where a spirit might not have been aggressive before, maybe a little shy, maybe a little retiring, becoming aggressive because they felt, I assume, under attack, and calming that situation. We've often had to go in and calm that situation and bring it to a resolution that was a little bit more difficult than it needed to be. I do agree with Noni. When people misunderstand magic and get involved in these sorts of things, it's usually a lot worse when you're going in to fix it. But the other is also true as well.
I suppose then for both of you, it's situations where you're basically trying to repair not only the situation with the haunting, but also the situation with the previous investigations, that having a breadth of knowledge where you're not confined to modern techniques allows you perhaps to sort of take a step back or reevaluate situations far quicker than someone who doesn't have the experience and the knowledge of other ways of dealing with situations.
Yeah, absolutely. That, you know, definitely it can be a way to use to remedy a situation. We definitely have some more tools in our kit. But we do find, to your point, that a lot of the repair work is because there has been some magical work or some paranormal investigation who've just not quite understood what they were doing. Maybe they've called out and they've invited
other spirits
to be there, and now it's a free-for-all. and not everybody who was invited has the best intention. You know, there's a lot of this sort of paranormal tourism.
Yes.
Creates a whole realm of issues.
Yeah, that's why we try to suggest be as specific as possible. We have a process when you first enter a space to use what's called enunciation, and to be as specific as possible about the spirit that's interacting with the living in that location. There are spirits all around us, human and non-human. Some are curious about us. Some are interested in what we're doing. Others are totally ambivalent to us. But when you invite them, that call can go out and can be heard and understood. And so in a lot of cases where the initial event is a fairly simple sort of haunting, by the time a 2-week investigation has gone on with the people involved, it's now a bus station of spirits there all trying to clamor for attention.
Yes.
And that can really blow things out as well.
Absolutely. Well, as with anybody that's had the misfortune of hosting a party that gets a wider invitation base than they were expecting, there will always be a few people that turn up that are certainly not welcome.
Absolutely. Learning how to gatekeep in these situations is really part of the process.
Yeah, watch those party crashers.
Well, they exist on every plane, it would seem.
Right.
When you've been working, though, as well, I suppose this is, as we've said, this is a constant evolution in your knowledge and your skill sets. Is it one of those things where you've gone to situations to help people and you've been at a complete loss at first? You're very surprised. You've been deceived perhaps by what information or the signs that you would be receiving, and you have to kind of take a step back, go away, reassess and come back with a different sort of approach? Or
that does happen. We talk about signs and movements in the book to be able to identify types of spirits and who's there. But those signs and movements, while they're objective realities, these aren't intuitive feelings. These are things you see and experience. While those are unique to those types of spirits, it's a dynamic environment. There is a load of events that can take place. And if you miss those signs, it can become very, very confusing. And you don't have those sort of waypoints to work through. And when you've got more than one spirit involved, it becomes even more confusing because we're not seeing them like we're watching CCTV. We're getting a whole bunch of events occurring, consequences of their actions. And when there's more than one present that are getting very active, it's very hard to identify those single strains of messaging that we're looking for. And it can become very, very confusing.
There's also, you know, the element of the people, the occupiers of this space, the living occupiers, and their experience of it. It can be sometimes a little difficult to try and tease out information in the way that you need it, because there's a natural tendency to try to create a linear pattern in people's minds when they try to relay these events. Well, first this happened, then this happened, and that caused that, and that caused that, and this is why I think it's escalating. The other thing is that just as that a spirit can be tethered because they have attachments, a human spirit can find that they are tethered to a situation. And trying to navigate that, there's a lot of ideas, there's a lot of emotion, there's a lot of experiences, both positive and negative, that the living are sort of entangled into the situation. And so very often when you have that situation, you can't just cut a cord. You have to unentangle it. You have to, you know, especially when you have individuals who might be giving power to the situation through their actions, you know, through no fault of their own. It just becomes a situation that you then just have to unwind and then carefully extract someone from it so that you can deal with the actual cause. And those situations can take a long time because some people are quite, you're unaware. It's happening on a very unconscious kind of level.
And as you know, with witness testimony, it's not always accurate because people want to fill in the gaps in between the points of events to try and understand it. So we also give methods of interviewing that change that up to get a little bit of more information out that maybe the witness isn't really aware of. And it's important to have those in your toolkit because someone can tell you their experience and their perspective can then wash over you if you're not guarded against that and looking for those pinpoints that you need in order to see the pattern.
Mm. Well, you mentioned that in the book in regards to, I suppose, one of the most modern quick fixes that you will find on any TikTok site or YouTube channel or whatever. People say, oh, you've got a problem, sage your house. That's it. That'll sort it all out. Sage it, sage it, sage it. But it doesn't work like that. And I think it sort of just dampens it down. It doesn't expel anything. But yeah. It's, as with anything, it's where you're getting the knowledge from. And if you don't have the resources, you're going to go, oh, well, I'm going to sage things, not knowing, but you might be just putting it off for a day, a week, a month, or it might even inflame the situation.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There is a time when sage is a good remedy. It can lift the environment. It can make it a little bit more difficult for a spirit to act. People think that expels spirits. It doesn't.
Unless they get bored because they can't act and they decide to wander off on their own.
Yes.
Which can happen. Mm-hmm. You know, but for the most part, what it's doing is it's changing the environment and making that environment less likely where they're going to manifest in a way that frightens people. It doesn't stop the communication. It doesn't stop any of those things. If you have a situation where a spirit is acting out and the cause of it is nothing that you really want to resolve, it's really just that the atmosphere is just lending itself too much to activity, sage is a great leveler. You know, it can create it, but it can also mask a problem. And so, you know, one of the things we recommend is don't go saging before you start. It's not going to protect you. It's not going to do anything. Try to understand what's happening first and then work out what the remedy should be. And, you know, equally, if you sage yourself before you go into an investigation, well, no spirit is going to want to come near you.
Yes.
So, you know, if activity is what you're looking for, then you've just made it really difficult for yourself to get any answers.
A lot of people think saging is only a Native American thing, but it goes back to medieval grimoires as well.
Yes.
The use of common cooking sage, the same sage you use on your chicken, is recorded in 14th century documents. And it comes with the caveat that it doesn't last. And in our experience, it lasts about between 2 and 3 weeks. And when we referred earlier to sitting through hours of these investigations, and we were struck by how many times it ends in a saging. And then when they review it with the inhabitants of the property later, it's like, oh, it lasted about 2 weeks and then it started again, or it lasted 3 weeks and it started again. It's almost a trope that it happens so often. And it's good to keep in mind that sage is a tool. It is not a absolute solution. And, and it's a tool among many tools.
Absolutely. I think too many people leap straight away. As you mentioned there, Rob, I remember my grandmother used to have a bag of sage. As a child, I always thought that was for the stuffing that she would make on a Sunday for our lunch. But it wasn't. She used to keep a bag just in case anything arrived, or, as she once explained to me when I was a little bit older, she just needed a break from them.
Yeah,
absolutely. Right. And a lot of these ideas, a lot of these traditions, they're there. You know, people have kept them there because, and seers especially, there's a lot of tradition around being a traditional seer that gets passed down, sometimes in informal ways through family, and sometimes in formal ways through, what might be more, you might think of more as a guild kind of structure. One of the things that we talk about, and we only just touch on it lightly, but I think that it is very relevant, is the role of a medium in paranormal investigation. We encourage the investigator or the magician to develop their own skills, to become competent in their own ability to see and hear, and the heuristic responses to be able to detect when there's anomalies. The role of a seer sometimes gets a little abused in the modern sense. And it's really just that as people are learning this skill, or they might have a natural skill, they haven't learnt some of the things that they need to protect themselves and protect their skill. And as you mentioned, taking a break from the spirit world is one thing. It's also, always been a caveat in our family traditions that someone who is a prophet or a seer does not interpret their own prophecy. That would be too much power in one person. And it doesn't lead to consistent good interpretation. Yeah. Somebody else should interpret it.
It leads to the self-validation paradox.
Yes.
And when you're investigating, a good seer is an incredible advantage, but they, one, shouldn't be the one to take the lead, because they're a good seer because they're emotionally sensitive, and you've got to maintain a detachment, especially in an investigation. But also, their material is never 100%. And so it has to go into the data, but not taken as a literal truth, but seen in its association with the other data that you collect. And you'll find often that psychic mediums, when they get involved in these things, can become very attached to the conflict of it, mm-hmm. or the emotions of it. I've seen this terrible thing that happened to this child, or how dare you do this? And they get drawn into the drama. And it's because the skill that makes them so beneficial is emotional. It's an emotional sensitivity. So knowing that you have them in a particular role protects them as well, mm-hmm. as protects the data that you're collecting.
So in a good investigation, and I think some of the early British investigations were good examples where you have a seer, but they have a role, and their role is to report what they see and experience, and somebody else then can confirm that or do some more research and sort of, see where it is falling into place. What often happens is that you know, people are sensitive and so they like to get involved and they, you know, start running investigations. And it's just, it's not a healthy practice. It's not healthy for them. It damages their skill. And often it's just that they just haven't had the training to know where to draw the line.
Yes. I mean, I recently watched a paranormal investigation where they essentially created a backstory with no evidence based on loose historical documents and then just ran with it. And by the end of the show, this ghost, that there was no evidence had ever been to this particular property of this particular character, had murdered a child of which there was no evidence in this particular property. And it was both of their spirits were in there haunting this particular house. And there was no evidence of this. There was no data. There was no historical records. There was no murder record in this particular house. There was certainly nothing in regards to the death of a child. And yet by the end of it, they was quite happily saying, well, this notorious murderer clearly killed a child in this house and that's what's going on. And I was just gobsmacked.
We've actually seen that a lot in our research. We've seen it more than once, or where it starts with a psychic reading and then they build a case from there.
Yes.
And, you know, it could just be whatever the psychic is experiencing at the day. It may not even be remotely related to the actual situation. You know, as someone who practices seership, you know, sometimes when images and messages come across, they are not specific to the question being asked.
Or the location.
And so that's up to the investigator and the analysis to determine whether those things are relevant or whether they just kind of, because the sea is open, they're receiving a whole bunch of things.
I suppose in your career as well, one of the things I've always been interested in is when somebody calls people such as yourself in, but they're not worried about what's going on. They want to know who it is. And often, once again, as we've been saying, the human mind will often create a narrative or fill in a gap or a blank and create a story that we want it to be. We want it to be a relative or a beloved pet that's coming back to us. And then when you guys come in, they say, well, actually, it's not Uncle George. It's somebody called Frank, and you don't know who he is.
That is not unusual. Look, human spirits, they need a certain environment to interact with our world. And if they don't have that environment where they are, they're happy to move to where that environment occurs. And so sometimes there's no link to the location. The person has no link to the location. Sometimes they have no link to anybody there or anything there. They've just decided that that place is a good place for them to set up shop.
They found it by accident.
Perhaps. Yeah, they found it by accident, perhaps, or they followed someone there. And you have to be cognizant of the fact that who you think it might be may not be that person at all. And so the best thing is if the spirit reveals who they are and tells you who they are. But the reality is you might need to work it out from when someone describes what they look like and the style of clothing puts them in a particular time period, or, you know, a type of music sets them off and they become more active and that fits a certain time period. And you got to sort of pull these little clues together and build a profile of who it is. And you can never assume who it is before you start.
And sometimes it's just not important.
No. Mm.
So I suppose you often have to deal with situations where you're helping people who are still grieving, and for them, they want it to be that person so much that I suppose that's quite a difficult thing to untangle it all and say, I'm afraid it's not who you think it is. That, once again, is, as you refer to and we've mentioned before, is treating this situation with compassion, because I can imagine that's probably one of the most fractious sort of interactions you can have with someone when you're invited into their home and you're basically saying it's not who you want it to be.
It, you know, that can happen. But another thing that happens very often and almost in all cases is whenever there is a spirit disturbance, there is almost always other spirits who are there to help the family or to help the person in question. You know, it's never one spirit. There might be one spirit that is the cause of a disturbance, but each individual also have their own relationship with their own ancestors, their own loved ones who are there trying to help them. And that's, you know, sometimes we're in an investigation sort of situation, you have to be careful not to get in the way of their ability to help them, because, you know, those ancestral spirits, what we identify the technology for them as Alas, they are there, you know, as guides. They're not imposing, and they can very often help navigate a situation. Often we'll go into, if we go into a situation where we're unsure, it's often those other spirit guides listening to them that can help reveal the situation. And, you know, they're often stepping in to protect their loved ones or a situation.
Also, when you do have grief involved and it turns out not to be the person they were hoping for, we like to remind them that that person is still there. You know, we all have personas or masks. When we pass over and we go through the whole process and become Alar, those masks disappear and the fullness of that person emerges. You can actually have a better communication and better relationship with someone who's moved on. And to bring the person who's in grief to that realization, and what it does is it makes whoever the spirit is irrelevant, because we know it's not the person they're hoping for, but you bring them back to a connection of the person that they love. And that way they feel connected and don't want to project on the events what they're hoping for.
That's a very interesting aspect, that, because that makes sense, because often you will have situations where people will have a situation that seems to go in peaks and troughs. Like sometimes the behavior will be off the scale and it'll be quite frightening, and sometimes nothing happens for ages. So therefore, you could suspect or suggest that whoever else is wandering around there is basically keeping a dampener on things for a bit, and then occasionally they just burst out for a bit and show off, and then everybody else who's hanging around trying to keep control of the situation for whoever is in that particular space, they're able to regain it and say, right, come on, enough now, back in your ghost box, out of the way.
Yeah, exactly right. And it, you know, it's definitely a long tradition in British culture to have, you know, the dumb supper, the, you know, candle that we light to as a vigil, and all those little things that we do that are part of a cultural events, that where we remember the people who we've loved, who've gone on before us, and remember that they're still there in some capacity. Just that veneration, keeping their photo, or those sorts of things help give them the kind of sustenance that they need to enact other situations, which might be controlling a disturbance, or it might be, you know, protection of the environment. You know, ancestors don't sort of rack off and leave as yes. soon as they, you know, hit the road. They some of them stay around and they guide us, and they're there in our dreams, and the communication is there. And sometimes, you know, we suddenly know what to do, and we don't realize that, you know, that it's been communicated to us in some way. If the spirit world is there, and the those things that people find frightening, or those disturbances, if those things are there, then there has to be the other side of it as well.
And sometimes it's we get lost in what's happening to us, but sometimes it just takes reminding someone that other side is there, that there's a beauty to it, and a closeness and a community with those we never actually lose anyone. We say those we've lost, but we never actually lose anyone. You bring them to mind and they are there. And it's as easy as that. And once people start to feel that connection, it really does bring a kind of peace.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, my grandfather passed 25 years ago this year, and I've got a picture of me and him taken 30 years ago nearly now, and it's by my doorway. So whenever I leave or whenever I come home, I always see that picture, and it always makes me smile. And it's the same as my love of gardening, because my grandfather loved to garden. He was a wonderful gardener, and he made his home look fabulous. It was to die for. I wish I was as good at growing roses as he certainly was. He was a very talented man. And it's little things like that I think people, as you say there, Rob, They're not lost. They're just not visible in the normal sense of the word. They're only a thought away. They're only, as we were saying earlier on, they're only the aroma of bread away, or a strong coffee, or you hear their favourite song. It's those emotional attachments that we sometimes forget that we apply to sound and smell and sense that I think, once again, seems to have been lost in the modern era because we try to deal with death as the end. But it isn't the end. They're always with us in whatever way. As you say, they're simply a thought away. And I think more of us need to deal with that, because that is often a great way of subsiding grief and the sadness that may follow someone you care of deeply passing away. Yes, it's unfortunate and it's sad that it's the one thing that all of us, whatever we try to do in our lives, it will always be there, whatever we do try to escape it. But we're simply a second away from coming back to life, as it were.
Yeah, and there's an analogy I like to use in these circumstances when I'm trying to explain this to people, to put it into perspective. Think of someone you truly love, someone who means so much to you, like your grandfather. And then imagine yourself sitting in your lounge, and he walks in the room, but you don't see him, but you know it's him because his presence is so familiar to you. And you know, when I look, I'll see him standing there. When they've passed, that is the very feeling that you get. That's the sense that they are there. They could walk. It feels like they walk into the room. That familiarity is there, even though we can't see them. And it can really fulfill your life when you think, especially when you're getting older.
Yes.
And you think back on the people that have passed. You're never truly alone, and you always have that guidance. And all you have to do is be mindful of it, be aware of it. And it's good to remind ourselves regularly to hold that mindfulness of them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's excellent advice from both of you. Before I let you leave, and I could talk to you both for the rest of the evening, but I'm sure you've got far better things to do. Do you have a favourite case that you've worked on? A case that when you remember it, it brings a smile to your lips? Because often people go, oh, what's the most frightening thing that's ever happened? But I think they're often, in my experience and the people I've spoken with in the past, those kinds of situations are very minimal. I would imagine that you've probably helped a lot more people, and you've got cases that when you sit and talk about them between yourselves, a smile passes over your face and it reminds you of either a really good experience, or you've traveled to somewhere fabulous, or you've had a really good sort of conversation with the other side for whatever it was.
It's a hard one.
Oh, that's a tough question.
I think in broad strokes, and we say this in the book, is when you're able to actually bring peace to a situation for both the spirit and the living. When the things that are traumatizing and broken are resolved and you see a tranquility descend, it's hard to put into words how powerful that experience is.
I have one that, I look back on with a sense of relief and satisfaction. Someone very close in my family was, I had moved away, I had left a lot behind, and they were very young, they were a teenager, and they were going through a situation where they'd moved into a house, and they had, for whatever reason, sort of started to be, they had attracted an obsessive sort of spirit. And it was starting to influence them in a lot of very negative ways. And they were getting very depressed and, their behavior was changing, and they were starting to sort of act out in ways that you would kind of recognize as being suicidal. And then it passed from one sibling onto another. And, eventually, and the whole family was being affected. And it was something that was going on I wasn't even aware of. But, resolving that situation because of their very, very religious beliefs, I was not able to help them directly. But I was able to resolve this situation and help bring those young teenagers back to a point of balance and protect them. And even though they will never know that that's the situation or what happened, that's definitely something that was a very worthwhile thing in my life that I look back and say, I'm glad that I was able to help them.
And they're doing really well now and very successful and happy. So
yeah,
that's always a good feeling too.
Fabulous.
Oh, and there was one other though. It was, in this case, it wasn't helping the living. It was helping a spirit. Remember the wee boy?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, time runs differently for them, but he had passed away in this particularly rural area, and he was afraid that his mother would be upset that he didn't have his jacket, that he went out without his jacket.
Didn't have his cardigan.
Yeah. And we helped resolve that, and that was a really beautiful moment that that I think will be with us for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah,
that's fun. Oh, lovely. Thank you both. I feel all warm and fuzzy now. Thank you. So the books is amazing. So where can everybody get hold of a copy of this, follow you online, and keep up to date with everything?
Right. Well, the book is published by Llewellyn. It is available from the Llewellyn, llewellyn.com. And it's also available on Amazon and everywhere that you find your favorite books. Barnes & Noble and I think Blackwell, I think, is the main distributor in the UK for it.
Yeah.
You can also get a link from our website. It is arcaneborders.com, where we talk about all sorts of interesting things from the Southwest Scotland and the borders. Or you can give me a ping on Instagram, which is arcane.borders.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Yep, that's it.
Yeah.
That's all right. Don't worry. Brilliant.
Because my family is from the borders and Galloa, and we talk about the spirituality of the borders. We call it Arcane Borders, but it's also the borders between this world and other worlds. Yes. That's kind of our little wordplay there. So,
well, as someone that's traveled through the borders, Rob, that makes perfect sense to me. Well, all I can say is thank you both for writing such a fabulously interesting book. It's something I would recommend to anybody with an interest in paranormal history, in investigations, in learning more about the culture, dealing with the negativity that's been prescribed to necromancy over the last 500-600 years. And I think it's an essential tome for anybody who wants to expand their knowledge base and learn some interesting things. And even if they don't want to go hunting for ghosts or spirits or trying to help people, the things you will learn simply by reading this book is well worth anybody's time. And I want to thank you once again for joining me and your kind and patient conversation. Thank you both.
Thank you. And I might add, having this book on the shelf, you might not be haunted yet, but who knows? Good to have it there.
Well, thank you, Paul. We've really enjoyed talking with you.